Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is Sunday, May the 22nd, 2022, and one more of my ongoing series of podcasts about all things affecting Americans abroad. And today I return to a very important topic with a very important past participant. Virginia Latoura Jeeker is joining me from Dubai because we're today ready to report yet another sighting of Mr. Akbar. And we cannot let this moment pass. Virginia, how are you?
Hey, John, I'm doing very well. And how are you?
Well, I am fine. And, this is one more of our series of podcasts, and I guess videos going back over the years about Mr. Akbar. And I must say that I now think of you as the world's most renowned Akbarologist. I've actually created a new word, I think, to describe this standard and caliber of learning about the most American of all Americans, Mr. Akbar. So, we're always looking for Mr. Akbar. Tell us about the most recent sighting we've got.
Right. Well, I'm sure that all of your listeners remember our friend Paul Manafort, who was involved with former President Trump. And today's discussion involves Mr. Manafort being subject to Akbar penalties and evidently not wanting to pay them.
Not wanting to pay them? Who could have known? So I understand.
Well, it's a pretty hefty penalty, John. It only involves a couple of tax years, two tax years, 2013 and 2014, and yet he owes close to $3 million in willful Akbar penalties, civil willful Akbar penalties.
Oh, well, that can't be too pleasant, especially since, as you wrote, as was in your recent blog post, apparently he's on the receiving end of a lawsuit from the Department of Justice, right?
Oh, yes. They're not happy with the fact he's not paying up. So this was an action to collect the penalty amounts that he owes.
So it's really just one more example of the Akbar fundraiser, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I was curious, because it was Manafort, whether he was thinking, because he was pardoned by President Trump, whether he was thinking this presidential pardon might forgive his Akbar penalties, which my research indicates clearly the presidential pardon would not extend to those penalties at all. Presidential pardons apply only to criminal actions, and this is a civil willful penalty amount under the Akbar rules. So no relevance at all to the presidential pardon, but we're not sure that Mr. Manafort fully understands that. I don't know.
Well, I think what we understand is that he doesn't want to pay the penalties. I think we're in agreement on that, right?
That's right. Absolutely. Doesn't want to pay.
All right. Well, I think it might be a good moment to do a bit of review here on what exactly, So to recap, right, very, very briefly, we've got a section in Title 31 that basically creates Mr. Akbar. And then, at the risk of oversimplification, essentially there's just a delegation to Treasury to make up the rules. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes. I think that's a good way to put it.
So I think it's reasonable to go to the FinCEN site to kind of see what the rules are. Now, in fairness, these do come from regulations, right? Actually, I think what I should have said was Treasury makes up the regulations, and the rules, which we find on the site, really come from those regulations, right? I think that's a little more precise, but starts off here on page 4. Who must file an Akbar?
So, John, you were looking at the Akbar instructions.
I am looking at the Akbar instructions coming from the FinCEN site.
Excellent. Okay. And you are correct that those do come basically from the Treasury regulations that were implementing the Bank Secrecy Act.
All right. So it's a consolidation. I guess it's an attempt to put those regulations into people talk so that the Mr. Manaforts of the world can understand us.
Yes.
But, you know, it starts off with a, you know, an obvious question, who must file an FBAR? And so I think we should start with that. It says a United States person that has a financial interest. Let's say who has a financial interest, but anyway.
A United States person can include an entity, so that's why I think they're using that.
Excellent. Absolutely. Good point. A United States person that has a financial interest in or signature authority over foreign financial accounts must file an FBAR. Then they talk about the $10,000 thing. But that seems to be one or the other, right? So a financial interest or signature authority over.
Yes.
Okay. Do you want to kind of pick up from there now? I think without getting into what a financial account is, because that could be in a whole other discussion, which I think we've actually had. Could you take us through what a financial interest is?
Sure. A financial interest, I think it's important for people to realize it can be many things, and it can be a direct ownership interest or what I call an indirect ownership interest. So let's take the simple one and let's look at the direct ownership interest in a foreign financial account. A U.S. person has a financial interest in a foreign financial account for which the U.S. person is the owner of record or holder of legal title, regardless of whether the account is maintained for the benefit of the U.S. person or for the benefit of another person. So I tell people, look at that first phrase, the United States person is the owner of record or holder of legal title. If you see your client, or you are the client and you are the owner of record or the holder of legal title, full stop, you need to file an FBAR if you meet the other requirements like the $10,000 aggregate. I think they're just emphasizing that the account could be maintained for the benefit of the U.S. person or another person. So I'll give you a simple example for this direct financial interest in. Let's say that you have elderly parents and they are having a foreign financial account because they live in a foreign country, and they give the title of that account to their child who is a U.S. person. So the person is an adult, is going to handle the financial affairs for his mom and dad. And he is listed as the legal owner. It's the bank account is in his name, even though the money's not his, even though he's only going to use it to pay his parents' bills and for their welfare, it does not matter. He has to file an FBAR reporting that account because he is the owner of record or the holder of legal title. So that's a good example of that first prong of who has a financial interest in a foreign financial account. That is a direct, what I call a direct interest. So we can move on to the next prong where it is an indirect ownership interest. And here you've got a lot going on because there can be many different, six different ways actually that you can be caught under this prong of the test. So a United States person has a financial interest in a foreign financial account for which the owner of record or holder of legal title is one of the following, and then it gives you a list. So the owner of record or holder of legal title is not the U.S. person who's responsible to file the FBAR. This is why I call it an indirect interest in the account. The account is actually owned by somebody else. Their name is on it. It could be an individual's name. It could be an entity like a corporation. So let's just look at, for example, I think the one we want to focus on today, the owner of record or holder of legal title is an agent, nominee, attorney, or a person acting in some other capacity on behalf of the United States person with respect to the account.
Okay. So let's pause there, Virginia. And I agree that for the purposes of this podcast, we're going to focus on that aspect of it. Now, let's go through that again and try to give that some context, right? The owner of record or legal title is one of the following: an agent, nominee, attorney, or a person acting in some other capacity on behalf of the United States person with respect to the account. Now, I'd like to give you a hypothetical here that I've often thought about. In a real estate transaction, I mean, United States citizens still do buy and sell homes. Very often they will put the money to buy the home in, say, an attorney or a lawyer's trust account.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that that particular circumstance is caught by what we just read? Attorney acting in some other capacity on behalf of the United States person with respect to the account.
Yes. So the owner of record or the holder of legal title is the attorney, and he's holding it on behalf of the U.S. person who's going to buy this real estate. Let's look at it. The U.S. person, who's the client of the attorney, he needs to report that foreign financial account because he has a financial interest in the account under this definition. The attorney, if he's a United States person, also needs to file it because he's the owner of record or holder of legal title. So you have one account and two different people reporting it on an FBAR, on their own individual FBARs.
Now, this is very interesting, and this is, of course, regrettable and sad, but let's look at this from two perspectives for a second, because it's amazing how far this goes. I actually agree with that interpretation, and this is something that, people don't think about at all, right? Lawyers' trust accounts or a real estate brokerage trust account or something of that nature. So, according to what we just read, the U.S. person would have to report on his FBAR the lawyer's trust account, right?
That's right.
The highest balance in the trust account?
I believe so. They're not telling you to, just give us the amount that's your money in that account.
I mean, this is shocking, isn't it?
It's a little bit scary.
I mean, it certainly is. So, is somebody going to call up their lawyer and say,
What's the highest balance in your trust account?
I need to know the highest balance in your trust account for the year. I need to know the account number. I need to know everything because I need to report a defense. And what do you think the lawyer's going to say?
My gosh, I don't know. It's going to be a tough call for the lawyer, eh?
The answer is no. They're going to say no. I mean, I think quite obviously, right?
Well, I think at a minimum, the U.S. person would know where to send that money. So he would know the bank it was at. He would know the account number. He would have certain information by virtue of having sent money to the trust account. He will not know the highest maximum balance, and he could say unknown.
Okay. All right. That's right. And that actually is, I think, a viable, reasonable, and explainable, use of that particular box, unknown, right?
That's right.
Okay. All right. Interesting. Interesting. Now, you make the point also that if the lawyer were a U.S. person, that, you know, and I agree with you that the lawyer would have an independent FBAR filing obligation, right? Absolutely. On the trust account?
Absolutely.
There's no way of interpreting these rules that would exclude that type of situation, correct?
No, not that I could find.
Well, I think that's right. And that's a very interesting problem. And it's one that, I'm not a real estate lawyer, right? Never have been, but it is interesting to me that the, you know, lawyers are required to have trust accounts if they're doing real estate and stuff like that. And that opens the door to this kind of stuff, doesn't it?
It certainly does, John. It certainly
so
does.
Would it make sense, for example, for a U.S. citizen who is purchasing a home to put in the contract of purchase and sale that under no circumstances will any money be transferred to a lawyer's trust account?
I don't know how they can get their deal done.
Well,
it's going to have, typically these things have to go into some kind of escrow account.
Yeah.
So you're going to have the problem. I mean, I think you're just being a little
mess, isn't it? It's definitely a mess, right? Because, you know, that seems to give the, you know, the U.S. personal financial interest in that particular account. Okay. So now remember the FBAR requirement arises if there's a financial interest or signature authority. So perhaps we could move down to signature. Now it's either or, signature authority. Could you take us through that?
Okay. So signature authority, according to the regulations that are enshrined here in the instructions to the FBAR, means signature authority is the authority of an individual alone or in conjunction with another individual to control the disposition of assets held in a foreign financial account by direct communication, whether in writing or otherwise, to the bank or other financial institution that maintains the financial account.
Okay. There are apparently exceptions, but let's not go there for the moment. Now, when I read that, that seems to me to cover the situation where, hey, we don't care if you have a financial interest in this or not. The very fact that you're able to control the disposition of it gives an FBAR obligation. Do you agree?
That's right. I think it helps to remind listeners why do we have this FBAR in the first place? And the point is the FinCEN wants to know if you're a US person, your relationship to this foreign account. They want to understand your relationship to it. So all of these issues about having a financial interest, or do you have signature authority? That's what they're trying to understand is, okay, you have this foreign account. What's your relationship to that account? And that's why you need to report accounts over which you may have no beneficial interest, like the money's not yours, it's somebody else's, but you have signature authority over it, or you have, you know, your name on the account for whatever reason. So I think people need to sit back and say that's why they're asking all of these questions. They want to know what my relationship is to this foreign account.
Well, they certainly want to know pretty much everything, don't they? And interestingly, scrolling down, child responsibility for child's FBAR. Look at this. Generally, a child is responsible for filing his or her own FBAR report. If a child cannot file his or her own FBAR for any reason, such as age, the child's parent, guardian, or other legally responsible person must file it for the child. It's pretty amazing.
Yes.
Do you think that public schools in America should be providing FBAR education?
Probably they should be, and obviously at a very early age. I mean, you know how they issue social security numbers when the child is born in the hospital? Maybe they should be issuing these instructions to FBAR as well at the same time.
Well, you wonder because, you know, this is very much part and parcel of what it means to be an American citizen, I think, isn't it?
That's right.
Okay.
So I want to mention in your example with the child's FBAR. So the FBAR would need to be filed. Let's say it would be prepared by the parent because the kid is too young, and it must be the FBAR would be in the child's name, et cetera. So the child submits his or her FBAR, but an important point to remember is most likely that parent has signature authority over the account because the child's too young. And so the parent then has to include that account on his or her own FBAR because they have signature authority over the account. So again, we're talking about the same account with an FBAR being filed by two separate people.
You know, it's like a family bonding ritual. We call it reporting together or something. What do you think?
Sure, why not? It could be FBAR. A family game night or something.
Absolutely, FBAR, bringing families, bringing parents and children closer together. All right.
Well, signature authority, John, also arises in some sticky situations, which I think people should be aware of. Quite often, there's a power of attorney being prepared by, let's say, the older parent, for example. And the power of attorney can be what's either called a durable power of attorney or something called a springing power of attorney. And the difference in these powers of attorney will directly impact the FBAR obligations of the individual who was given the power to deal with the financial accounts. So your power of attorney will not generally ever list banks and bank accounts, etc. It will just say the power holder, my child, John Smith, is given the power to deal with all of my financial accounts throughout the world, or something very general like that. And this power of attorney, if it's a durable power of attorney, it comes into effect immediately when the principal signs it. Meanwhile, the power holder, the child in my example, John Smith, may not even know he has that power of attorney over the accounts because typically the POA is being held by the lawyer with the estate planning documents, etc. So this causes a problem for people, a potential problem that they may not even know they have signature authority over an account by virtue of the power of attorney. A springing power of attorney is a little different from a durable one. The springing power springs into being upon usually the disability or mental incompetence, etc., of the principal. So the power holder doesn't get the power right away. He only gets it later in time. That's when the FBAR duty would technically arise. And unfortunately, powers of attorney not only create FBAR problems for people, they create all sorts of other problems like durable power of attorney. There could be a big lag of time between the time the parent becomes ill and the maybe doctors give the required, yes, he's disabled and can't do anything. You know, sometimes the power of attorney will not be respected until there's a physician's write-off confirming the disability. So this can be very troublesome in the real world and in the world of Mr. FBAR.
So what you're saying mm-hmm. is that there may be a whole class of people out there who have FBAR obligations and don't even know about it.
It's possible, yes, absolutely. Now, what I advise clients who come to me with this problem is we dig deep and I try and find out, will the particular bank respect that power of attorney? Or do they say, no, 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 we don't accept POAs. We only accept, you know, the signing on our particular bank form. So it's possible you may escape the problem depending on the financial institution, what it will accept or not. But, you know, the issue is you may certainly have a problem.
Well, this is amazing stuff. It's absolutely frightening. I think largely it's frightening because it's so difficult to get clearing. I mean, in the basic situation, the obligations are clear. But I mean, do you think it's reasonable that any normal person could know about things like corporation owns directly or indirectly more than 50%, you know, this sort of stuff?
No, they won't. Not unless they're reading the FBAR instructions.
It's crazy, right? It's crazy. I mean, you've got all this responsibility out there and, you know, this huge penalty base for people who don't even know that they have these requirements. Okay. Very interesting stuff. Let's now move over to the claim that the Department of Justice made against Mr. Manafort.
Okay.
You know, I recommend this as reading to all would-be FBAR scholars of the world. You know, we understand the basic context that, you know, Mr. Manafort was assessed FBAR penalties, didn't want to pay. So the Department of Justice did what the Department of Justice does, namely brought a lawsuit against him, right? To enforce the judgment. And paragraph 12, which is on page 4, begins with a description of Manafort's financial assets. Now,
John, just to clarify, we are now looking at the complaint filed by the Department of Justice.
Correct.
We are away from the instructions. We are now at the complaint, paragraph 12. Yes.
Absolutely. Now, without getting into all of the details, could you, in a general way, sort of explain what these foreign financial accounts were?
Sure. Okay, so Mr. Manafort was doing consulting work in Ukraine, and he was doing this through various foreign companies that were set up. Some of them were set up by other people at his instruction, and he had various financial accounts set up in different banks in Cyprus, St. Vincent and Grenadines, and the UK, to collect the monies from his consulting work in Ukraine. In some cases, he was listed as an authorized signer or beneficial owner of the particular bank accounts. But with many of the accounts, they were held without the use of his name at all. They were held in the name of nominee shell corporations that were opened and operated by other individuals on behalf of Mr. Manafort. So,
Virginia, can I ask you to just pause there for a minute? Because what you're saying is incredibly significant. And that's actually captured in paragraph 16 of the complaint. And I'd like to read that into our podcast. All right.
Okay.
In some instances, Manafort was listed as an authorized signer or beneficial owner of the account, right? So that's just the signature authority, right? However, many of the accounts were held without the use of Manafort's name at all. Rather, the accounts were held in the name of nominee shell corporations. And when I read that, I find myself going back on the FBAR instructions to, to the directions that basically talk about the two prongs, right? The financial interest and signature authority that we just discussed. That's what paragraph 16 is capturing, isn't it?
Yes. Absolutely.
Okay.
It could also be capturing the owner of record or holder of legal title is some agent, nominee, somebody acting in some other capacity on behalf of Mr. Manafort. Could also be capturing that. It could also be capturing a corporation in which the United States person, Mr. Manafort, owns directly or indirectly more than 50% of the total value or voting power of the shares of the company. So the complaint is worded quite broadly, but it's because it wants to capture every possibility. And the possibilities I see are not only the signature authority, but somebody else acting as an agent or nominee for him, or you know what, the corporation was set up by him, even though at his behest, even though it was set up by another individual. But the true owner was him, owning 50%, over 50% of that company. And I think the complaint can capture any of those possibilities. And they're just not spelling it out because they don't want to spell it out.
Yeah, they don't want to be restricted by being overly narrow.
That's correct.
But to go back, you know, to link this again to, you know, the relationship between the language in the complaint and the language in the filing requirements, right? So again, there's an obligation to file the F4 with a financial interest or signature authority. Now, when we discuss financial interest, we restricted our discussion today to the owner of record of legal title, et cetera, but also noting the owner of record includes agent nominee, corporation, partnership, what have you, trust. And yes, what they're doing is describing this thing in language that would potentially capture any and all of those circumstances. Agreed?
Yes, agreed, for sure.
Okay, now moving back to the language of the complaint, in paragraph 17 is amazing, right? Because, you know, so we go through 16 where they're, you know, trying to, you know, paint this with a very broad brush. But in 17, they say, regardless, Manafort still exercised control over and had access to each of the accounts, which is really it's a summary statement, isn't it? No matter how we look at this, this is caught by either signature authority or financial interest, correct?
That's right. That's right.
Now that's interesting. And I think to some extent this is interesting because I'm not saying that, you know, this hasn't been done before, but, you know, your blog post, thank you for that blog post, caused me to actually sit down and read this complaint. And as I read it, I thought, oh my God, you know, this has application way beyond Mr. Manafort, right? Particularly the language, regardless, Manafort still exercised control over and had access to each of those accounts, right?
Yes.
And the example that we were talking about the lawyer's trust account would be only one example of that. Do you think that this principle could have any application? I'm not saying that I think it does, but I'd be interested in your view of this. Do you think this has any application to a situation of a bank account owned by your spouse that, you know, you, for example, have a bank card to, but the account is not in your name?
Could certainly do, because it sounds like you have access to the account and you may be deemed by virtue of that to have some kind of signature authority over the account. I think that's pushing it a little bit, but I think certainly it's a possibility. I think in the family bank account situation, you may have a situation where the account is strictly held, let's say, in the foreign spouse's name, and you have a U.S. spouse that they are married to, And if they're living in a community property jurisdiction, then that non-resident alien, foreign spouse, could certainly be treated as holding the account. The account holder is someone who has the account on behalf of the U.S. person, because the U.S. person has some kind of ownership interest in that account by virtue of community property rules in that jurisdiction. And regardless of whether the U.S. individual's name is on that account, it's irrelevant. You will fit within that language of having a financial interest. The owner of record or holder of legal title is a person acting in some other capacity on behalf of the U.S. person with respect to the account.
Yeah, I mean, this stuff, although probably irrelevant to most people's lives in the sense that nobody could imagine this could be the case, the thing that concerns me about something like this paragraph 17 of this complaint is just the basic language: regardless, Manafort still exercised control over and had access to each of these accounts. That simple sentence describes a principle of indescribably broad application, do you think?
Yes, I do. I do, John.
And this is the problem, you know, that these things start with a situation that most in the world would agree is sort of an egregious state, egregious situation, right? And then somehow, you know, it begins the process of being carried down to more pedestrian situations. And I think we've seen
that's
so
the problem.
Much of that.
Absolutely. Yes, I understand what you're saying. You know, Manafort clearly is an example of an egregious case. These were his bank accounts for all intents and purposes. We all know that. But use of this language, if the courts stop looking at the precise facts that were involved here and move it over into the more benign case, a lot of people will have a problem. And unfortunately, the trend I've been seeing with FBAR is that the courts are giving the government more and more leeway. You know, it all started with the burden of proof. What's required for Treasury to show somebody was willful? Is it the clear and convincing evidence standard, or is it the preponderance of the evidence standard? And the courts have gone on to say, well, it's the lower standard. They all seem to be moving in that direction. Whereas in the early days, there was more of a discussion, an argument. It could be the higher clear and convincing evidence burden of proof required. No longer. Now it seems accepted that it's the lower standard. Then we had, well, what does it mean to be willful? To have willfully non-complied with FBAR. In the early days, we were looking at, well, it's the intentional violation of a known legal duty. So if you didn't know about FBAR, then you couldn't have willfully not complied. Well, over the years, that has been whittled down by the courts, and they are looking and saying, well, no, wait a minute. Willful blindness counts as willful. Reckless disregard of the instructions, et cetera, counts as willful noncompliance. So we've been seeing over time that the courts are giving the IRS far more leeway in assessing these FBAR penalties and getting FBAR issues, winning them. So I think that your concern with this language and complaint is certainly valid if we look to the historical significance of how FBAR has developed.
Well, I think that's right. Another example outside the context of FBAR, of I think the general principle of, you know, what I'm going to call application creep, right, would be the whole area of the foreign trust rules. You know, if you go back to the 90s, it is inconceivable to me that these rules ever could have been designed, you know, to apply to basic non-U.S. pensions and things like that. I mean, it seems to me they were so clearly designed to deal with U.S. residents who would create foreign trusts. you know, and try to get asked, you know, argue they didn't own things, et cetera. And here we are in 2022. And my God, I mean, the IRS just a couple of years ago assessed a litany of $10,000 penalties for late filing of Form 3520 on things that arguably were not even trusts, right?
Yes, yes.
So this is a gigantic problem. Virginia, do you think that there needs to be congressional hearings or some kind of commission on FBAR?
Well, there needs to be something. Now, you know, the issue is going to the United States Supreme Court if they accept to take on the case. On what is the will? I'm sorry?
Which case is the U.S. Supreme Court is? The conflict in whether the penalty is per account or per form. Oh my God! Yes. Actually, yeah. Could you recap what that's about? This is amazing.
Right. So that was the case of Mr. Bittner, who unfortunately had quite a few foreign financial accounts, which he did not file the FBAR for, and was assessed a hefty penalty. I can't remember the amount. The IRS had calculated the penalty by multiplying the $10,000 willful FBAR violation non-willful FBAR violation by the number of accounts that were should have been put onto the FBAR.
So if the man had, per account, right?
Yes. So if the man had 10 accounts that were not listed, his penalty would be 10 accounts times $10,000, which would be a $100,000 penalty for that particular year. Mr. Bittner argued, well, no. It should only be, the violation should only be viewed as not filing the FBAR for that year. So it would be one form was required, Form 114, the FBAR, and it should only be a $10,000 penalty. So at the end of the day, the Fifth Circuit said, no, we agree with the IRS. It should be $10,000 per account that wasn't listed. And now we have a conflict in the circuit courts because we had a Ninth Circuit decision holding the other way in the case of Boyd, B-O-Y-D. So the Boyd case held that the penalty should only be $10,000 per FBAR form that was not filed. And Mr. Bittner, who lost in the Fifth Circuit, has now requested the U.S. Supreme Court to review and resolve this conflict between the circuits. And by the way, the U.S. Solicitor General is all for it. They want the U.S. Supreme Court to make this decision. They have written a brief. And if you read carefully that brief, they have basically said now is the time that is appropriate for the U.S. Supreme Court to resolve this issue. So let's see where that goes. I think the U.S. Supreme Court may take it on.
I mean, that is extraordinary use of the highest court in the land, isn't it? I mean, to decide whether the IRS can levy a penalty of $10,000 per account versus per form. I mean, doesn't that tell you the extent to which FBAR and information returns have become important in the United States?
Oh, they are just, they're critical. They're critical. And we see it growing every year.
You know, this stuff is, I mean, it's absolutely shocking. I mean, is there any other country in the world that is so obsessed with forms and penalties as the United States?
Not that I know of, John, but I can't say that with absolute authority.
Yeah, well, it is amazing stuff. Well, anyway,
I'm doing a blog post on that issue that people can read about the U.S. Solicitor General coming up with wanting the U.S. Supreme Court to resolve this. I have a blog post coming up on this matter. So
I certainly look forward to reading that. In that brief, are they arguing one way or the other for what the result should
yes,
be?
Yes, they're arguing, of course, that they should have $10,000 per form. Oh, and they, I must
that's
say,
that's shocking to me.
I'm sorry, per account. They make some compelling statements in the brief. I talk about them in the blog post.
Who could have known? Well, I guess that those who characterize this as nothing more than as the FBAR fundraiser probably are correct, do you think?
Yeah. I think that blog post should be coming up next week, John. So be on the lookout. Come up next Thursday.
Well, I look forward to it. And I think that you're performing a tremendous public service by keeping the world educated and alerted on all of these sightings of Mr. FBAR. And as you know, I consider you to be the world's most renowned FBARologist. And I thank you for discussing this with me today.
And you're welcome, John. It's a pleasure.
And how would people get a hold of you to learn more about Mr. FBAR or to discuss
future
sightings?
Sure. They can certainly check my website, which is a very, I think, simple U.S. tax blog dealing with international issues. It's not strictly for the professional. Laypersons also understand what's being written. And that can be found at www.us-tax.org, O-R-G.
All right. Well, thanks very much. And I certainly look forward to reading that blog post and catching up with you again soon.
Okay, John. Thanks for having me.